Norton, through his, the position he took, it caused the financial fraternity at Ford to effectively understate the volumes and from the scheduling point of view. When our car came out in the marketplace, it took off like a rocket. But Norton had effectively given it this handicap, and there were no cars. No cars. I mean, when you fool around with the family jewels like that, you're talking a loss for a company in those days. You could be talking a loss of $50 to $75 million, very conservatively. We never could fight Chevrolet with this car, not because it wasn't a damn good design. It was because they had, the people who had scheduled the car had said it was a loser. That stayed on my mind. I just, you know, when I met the man here at Chrysler, he was here for a short time. I couldn't meet him without thinking about that. I mean, that bothered me. Son of a gun. I mean, it was something else.
Did it ever get out at all? Or just briefly?
Oh, it came out.
Oh,
it came out. Everything, it came out, but it was so in demand. Our sales performance was just, you know, a fraction of what it could be. It went off like a rocket. It was very much in demand. I can't think of the name of it, but it was Ford's Monte Carlo fighter, and it was built with a, you know, as I say, it was designed with a, you know, a $10 to $15 million tight budget, and we did a hell of a job. But we just, of course, we just got screwed up there with that thing. And I think the company could have sold two or three times the number of cars they sold.
It completely undercut you.
Well, you see, once you schedule a car, if those decisions that are made by the hierarchy of the company, once they're made, those are absolutely.
Really?
Oh, you don't say, Jesus, I think we understated it. We got to go back and state. No, the business doesn't have that quality.
Doesn't have that resilience.
No. If you've done that and you plant loaded, and you've got everything set up, that die is cast. That's the end of it. So it just wiped out that car.
We'll have to find out what that make was. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about
yeah.
it next time.
Yeah, I'd like to very much.
Good. Well, that's not a good place to start.
The name of that vehicle that we were discussing was the Elite. I can't recall whether it was a Torino Elite, or I don't think so. I think it was the Ford Elite, and that was the competitor to the Monte Carlo. Very effective.
It was a truly successful car in terms of sales.
Oh, it was, yes.
Uh-huh.
It was successful, but I think I was disappointed that they couldn't meet the demand. The demand far exceeded our volume capacity.
You mentioned last time that it's almost impossible to do that. Can you elaborate on that a bit, as to why they couldn't up production as they can today, pretty much?
Yes, they can. We're doing quite a bit of it here at Chrysler. Once we have a market, a performance in the marketplace that gives us an indication there is demand. we're going to do it in the case of the T-115.
Mm-hmm.
That's a case of a vehicle that was conservatively planned, and we're rushing ahead now to increase our capacity to build more of them.
This is the
The van, the minivan.
The van, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Dodge Caravan.
And the, yes, right, and the Plymouth
Voyager,
right.
Interesting footnote of that, before we move back again in time. I think I've heard Mr. Iacocca quoted as saying, it's easy when you've done it before. Is that a correct quote from him?
Yes.
Does that mean that you and he worked on that before you left Ford?
Right, for about a decade.
Yes, right.
Right, the a vehicle called the Mini Max.
The Mini Max. Right.
And I built, conservatively, a half a dozen of those Mini Maxes.
Did you?
At Ford, my base was limited somewhat because the only front system that I had was the Fiesta. So I built some Minimax based on the Fiesta drivetrain. That was gave me that was an examination of a little smaller package than we. The direction that we took here at Chrysler, but it was an appealing vehicle, and we did a number of those. I never could clearly understand Ford's decision making process that brought them to the judgment that they shouldn't do it. I know that the market research that was conducted left no doubt that it was a 10 strike. In fact, as I recall, Ford's research on the Minimax was one of the highest numbers that they'd ever experienced. But there was a body of opinion which can is relatively commonplace to within a company with any of the big three or perhaps any automobile manufacturer. There's a body of opinion that tends to have a considerable difficulty dealing with any vehicle solution that has no historical background or foundation.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's right now. It's interesting. At the time, it ticked me off.
Mm-hmm.
But age has mellowed me, and so now it's interesting.
Yeah.
At the time, I thought it stunk. The fact is those people, of course, they create. Challenges that are in the what is it?
Mm-hmm.
There's marketing people are particularly rife with this quality. They don't want to know about it. If they haven't seen it before, seen it performed before in the marketplace, you've got problems, I'll tell you. Those people are something else. And not to suggest they singularly sunk the Minimax, but let's face it, they were opponents of the Minimax. And there's members of the hierarchy of the company that were doubtful about it because there was no base for to it was you know the world of the automobile when I started in it was definitely offered a lot of what would you say? A lot of frustration, certainly, to many of us, because it was. Although I'm not a visionary of the category of Alex Tremulous, but I could appreciate what Alex was going through, because his observations were far more profound and than mine. But I experienced a lot of frustration, because really our world was confined to the creative person being confined to almost a you could almost say a grunt status, because the thinking people, which were the people in product planning and various members of management, they decided what was going to be done. It's like painting with number by numbers. And the grunts were assigned to put a new grill inside the opening. You put a new molding on, a new molding section, or a new flag at the beginning of the molding. You did a new tail light lens, you might change a wheel cover, but that was about the extent of it. So in that climate, you can imagine what you can imagine. Really, you could relate Lee Iacocca to what he experienced when he decided that what the company needed was the Mustang.
Right.
You know, I mean, what Mustang? Christ, who needs a? You know, there were a lot of people who, I'm sure, were resistant, and. He did the same thing with the Mark III. You know, he caused the Mark family to start because he's very, very imaginative, very creative, and not easy to sink. I mean, if he believes in it. He's a mover and shaker, so we have the good fortune of have a management person with that particular quality. But otherwise, the climate of the business for many, many years was very repetitious, quite frankly.
Let's expand on that a bit, if I may, and let me preface it with something I'm sure you know. In a recent television interview, Henry Ford II was asked about the Mustang, and he said, quite frankly, he said, I've been hearing lots of things about, or he said, I've been hearing reports that Stu Fry thinks that he was Don Fry thinks that he was the originator of the Mustang. He said, but it was Lee's car all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
He said he initiated and he pulled
right.
it through. Can you since you were there at a very good vantage point at the time of Iacocca's rise in the Ford Motor Company, could you expand on his role and your role vis-a-vis the designer and the energetic and creative top executive in terms of design decisions at that time, the late 60s and the early 70s?
Well, there was no question in my mind that Lee brought a dimension to the business that I hadn't experienced before. It offered an opportunity that was quite exciting to all of us. Some of us were more closely related to it from a vantage point, and to be participants in programs. But the I think the there was, as there is normally in business, I think there were people, as someone has coined the expression, you know, every successful car has many fathers. People line up wanting to be identified as the creator of that, and we've talked briefly about the 1949 Ford as a case in point. It's almost funny. There were, I think, in every business, and they certainly existed at Ford. Anything as successful as the Mustang, of course, would be fair game, as far as a person as Don Fry is concerned. I think Don had a was a person of considerable knowledge and ability, but I think he had a an ego that would bring him to that conclusion that he should identify with it and take credit for it. So I think it's not unusual to find that. It's never particularly I don't find it acceptable, but it's familiar to me. But my role in the Mustang was sufficiently heavy to give me a good feel and understanding of who created it, as I said, that followed in the Mark family as well. I didn't have the good fortune to be on the receiving end of the light going on regarding the need for a Mark. The Mark, original Mark III, was done jointly by Lee Iacocca, and he dealt with a chap by the name of Art Queerfield, mm-hmm. and Art created the first Mark III at Lee's direction. I came into the Mark program was in the fourth and fifth Mark, which were two revisits to the subject, where we followed an approach which I strongly favored, and that was to based on the success of the Mark, was to drift the Mark more into an obvious direct relationship with the Rolls-Royce. And if you'll notice, our design leaves no doubt that we were inspired by the Rolls. I think we suffered a little bit of a design handicap in that I liked the choice that Lee made directed Art to work in the original Mark III. That came off of the Thunderbird. Mm-hmm. And of course that package was ideal. Mm-hmm. To me, that was, I had the feeling, although I didn't, I didn't verbalize it, but I had the feeling that's where the Mark belong from the package point of view. I would have liked to have kept it there, but this time I had to come off another car. I came off of a large car, and the mark grew. Now, it was very successful, and I think it was very attractive, but it was a much bigger, more massive, long car, just huge, as I look back on it, or I see one on the street today.
Yeah.
I think that was a less, kind of an unfortunate thing. It happens in car business because a car will go through the, you know, will phase out, and the... that platform that you are using is disappears, and you're confronted with having to plan your car of the future on another platform. And we're fortunately not confronted with that here at Chrysler, which is I find very pleasing. We have for reasons that are obvious, in that we, under Lee's direction, have just survived a bloodbath here. Our whole view of the future is far more. Is far better and more, I think more attention is being played to the future of our various cars in the various categories of cars. So our platform programs are well thought out, and it gives the process flexibility. And it gives the designer an incredibly good opportunity to respond to
this sort of atmosphere was conspicuously lacking in the Ford Motor Company in the early 70s, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Right.
Which was most very frustrating to both Mr. Iacocca and yourself at that.
Yes, time. Right. It was. It.
Any particular reason for that? You can think of. Was there a lack of flexibility at the top? Do you think?
Well, I had the. I think it was even with a kind of a faulty memory. There was the entry of Knudsen into the scene.
Which really muddled the waters.
Boy, that's a very. Kind and dignified way to express it. It was a horror story.
Do you care to expand on that episode?
Well, it was a. I was, you know, although I had, from a career point of view, I had been at Ford long enough that I had survived and been through you can call it some degree of unpleasantness, the kind of instability, the kind of that comes from having a the appearance and disappearance of various presidents of the company. Consistency was Mr. Ford himself, but from the time I started, really as a manager and so forth, which was relatively early after I joined Ford, we had a variety of people running the design center until the air got cleared and Jean Bordonnais was given the responsibility. So we had people coming and going from Raviola to, you name it. There was a new man coming in from somewhere that was going to tell us how to do our business. And also at the top, I mean, from the time you know, from Ernie Breach, including Ernie Breach, to and it just went on and
Crusoe,
on.
Crusoe, all of them, R.J.
Some of those people I had a better, created a better rapport with than others. I had a good relationship with R.J. Miller.
Yes.
I had a rocky kind of relationship with Ernie Breach, and of course, I wasn't particularly enthralled with the appearance of Knudsen. I didn't understand it. I didn't, and of course, promptly, Bourdonnais, in his inimitable way, for reasons I never have discussed with him, chose to assign two Knudsen agents to work for me. Well. The Oriental chap,
Larry Shinoda,
and Bill, can't think of his last name, Bill, very nice fellow. Both of those fellows reported to me, which I tried to grin and bear it. I was not particularly pleased, and I never, I'm a saluter, so I guess I, you know, I saluted, and that was it. I just almost immediately, it was made common knowledge that that the they had, that Knudsen had brought in, vis-a-vis with Larry Shinoda, a hit list, which was a list of all the people they were going to get rid of promptly. I guess I felt fairly flattered, because Lee Iacocca was on it, and I thought that's fairly good, you know, that's a
good company.
Good company. Bourdonnais was on it, and Don Della Rosa was on it. And
was this Shinoda's hit list? Or
was
it was a
hit list that I think I never really could find out, but I had the feeling it was after I watched Shinoda operate, I had the feeling it was Shinoda's list that he made up, maybe at the request of Knudsen. You know, like new people entering a new company, I think it's not unusual for them to want a clean house, and of course they had this list.
Clear out the dead wood.
Yeah, get rid of the dead wood. So that was, it was, I'll never forget a particular episode that so completely brought that into perspective. One morning, I had been asked, I think it was by Bourdonnais, I had been asked to design a trophy to be given to as an award as part of the award process at the Indianapolis 500 mile race that would honor Mr. Knudsen's Bunky's father.
Yeah, that's right.
So I played a role in the designing of this trophy, and one of my people in my organization did the worked with me, or I worked with them to do an illustration of this trophy, and I failed to remember just exactly how this thing blew out of, you know, up to this proportion, but I remember this particular morning. And by the way, Knudsen was a put us all in shock, because Knudsen let us know that he he came to work at 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
Plus, guess where he started his work, which struck me as kind of interesting for the president of the company to come to the styling center. And I thought that didn't flatter me. That I thought, Jesus Christ, you know. I mean, being president has got to be fairly complex.
Yeah.
What the hell would he come to the styling center for? But nonetheless, he was on another path, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So this particular morning, we arranged upstairs in Johnny Nager's area and I don't know, the part I don't remember is how the group became so august. We had, here's De La Rosa, here is, of course, Shinoda, Knudsen, and Iacocca. And I can't remember, and Bourdonnais, of course.
Right.
So here's all of us, and I'm showing this this trophy to Knudsen. I am trying to show it. I think probably really Shinoda showed it. You know, I mean, he was not about to let me, you know, get into the act there. So we are all standing there, and Knudsen made a remark about the I had floated into this crystal, which probably would, I think, rather than crystal would be acrylic, or the head of his father in there, William Knudsen. And that it was, I have a colored photograph of it at home.
Do you?
Yeah, it's an interesting. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very nice piece of work.
Sounds fascinating.
But the way this evolved, it was funny. God, it's all you could do to keep from laughing. So Knudsen's looking at this, and he's being he's saying, you know, good things about it. He likes it, you know.
That draws his father.
Yeah, and he thought it was very nice, and so forth, and he said to Larry Shinoda, he said, you know, I've got a small sculpture piece of my father's head out at the house, and he said, why don't you come out, Larry, and this is in front of him, why don't you come out this weekend and pick it up, you know. Well, Larry, for some reason or other, said, I'll come out I'll come out Saturday afternoon and get it. And Knudsen says, no, he said, don't, he said, come out Saturday evening and bring your wife for dinner. Now, here is all of this in front of Iacocca, and, you know, I thought, son of a gun, this is way out. I couldn't, you know, it just it was just incredible. And it was you know, he was a different kind of person. He was I to this day I don't understand what his, you know, I heard other things, like he was always attacking Ford's engineering department. And Knudsen had, you not only had Bill and Larry Shinoda in the styling part of it, but he also, I noticed, was attracted to people like that in other areas as well. Like, every time he would start bad mouthing Ford Engineering, he had a person that he would call and have come up to Ford, and who is at best, you know, one of the, his name is Smokey Unick, and Smokey Unick is well known in NASCAR, you know, as an engine builder.
Yeah.
But I mean, Smokey Unick, you know, and here's Smokey Unick with his sweat-stained T-shirt and his bill cap and a can of beer, and I mean that's, you know, and you think, what the hell is going on, you know? And Smokey Unick will take over and tell you how to design all the future engines for. It was, I'll tell you.
It sounds like a comic opera.
It really, it was.
But it wasn't so comic at the time, obviously. At least in terms of.
No, a lot of people got quite upset. I don't know. I have some ability to see the humor in it. So I actually kind of enjoyed the humorous side of this. You know, it. You know, and that's kind of tough to, you know, when you're. To see humor in it, if the person has already submitted that they have a hit list when you're on it, so, you know. Excuse me a moment.
The situation then just got worse, did it not, at Ford in the middle of Gibson's tenure?
Yes, it did. It got very,
in terms of design,
very bad, and Knudsen caused some design decisions that were, I thought, were very unfortunate on our, particularly on, we had some cars that were, the timing of the design process was such that they were easy to fall victim to his influence, and it caused us to put a peculiar looking front end on the Thunderbird and so forth, and it was an effort on his part to, I recalling him telling us that, you know, it was, should look like a Pontiac. I thought that was kind of honest and strange.
He had just come from Pontiac.
Yeah, so he thought that, you know, it should look like a Pontiac. That was what was wrong with us, that we didn't know how to do that. So he caused a very strange looking front to get on the Thunderbird.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
No, I'd have to have a car mm-hmm. book.
The early 70s?
Yes, right. It was the early 70s.
The infighting must have been fierce, I suspect, at this point. Bordenay and you and Mr. Iacocca on one side, and Knudsen and Shinoda and his henchmen on the other.
Yes, right.
And the design center caught in the middle.
Right. So, yeah. Now, of course, Lee is a. You know, as a fighter, and I think that I probably far beyond my understanding of what was going on behind the scenes. I was, we all hoped that he was going to do something about it. I didn't know in what form it would come, and a condition like that. Can be rather threatening because you can you don't know how effective the person that you think is going to your hope or will be the winner. You don't really know how effective he can be. Here's the chairman of the board that's brought this man in. I mean, the whole thing was so strange that none of us could, at least I never could understand it. Maybe Bordenay understood it, but I certainly didn't understand it. Henry was, and is, a different kind of person, and I, that was a demonstration of his uniqueness that wasn't particularly pleasing, you know, that kind of a...
Kind of an impulsive decision.
Well, it seemed to be. I didn't know what was going on in his mind, naturally. I think, as I look back on it, and you know, and have, and I looked at what happened later on, much later on, I guess it perhaps there was some element that that had that was similar to the you know, that later on resulted in Lee being fired from Ford. Something was brewing there that I don't think any of us were aware of. But of course Lee, being a fighter, of course was, he formed he put together a group of us. It seemed to be a penchant of Henry's for reasons that I never clearly understood, except that perhaps from a psychological point of view, he viewed it as somehow threatening or something. He was always critical of Lee's, I forget how he, what he called them, Lee's team. A team is a positive kind of statement about associates of a person, but he wasn't calling us Lee's team. It was, I forget what he called us, but it wasn't good, you know. I mean, he didn't like, Lee would travel to Europe with a select group, mm-hmm. and Lee would do this with these people, and he'd do that, and Lee talked about this person or included this person in this particular thing.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about the you were talking about the very interesting relationship that evolved between Mr. Iacocca and Mr. Ford in the late 60s, and which triggered the coming of Mr. Knudsen. And you were about to, embark on a rather interesting explanation of how that happened.
Well, the Mr. Ford expressed, he made a number of negative remarks that reached me, and through a variety of sources, some Bourdonnais, other sources as well, that he was, that had ultimately were could be interpreted as critical of Lee and critical of Lee's, the group that Lee associated with more closely. In fact, Lee, it included quite a cross section of the company. For instance, Bourdonnais and I and a chap from the finance staff and a number of different people. I think Lee's limit in the Gulfstream, too, was like, I think six or seven of us would go to Europe. And Lee, that was all the people he wanted, and those were the people he wanted, and so forth. So that kind of thing, you know, I think the decision to do things like that reached the chairman, and he was constantly negative about it. And of course, after the coming of Knudsen, we, most of us, didn't know, really had no way of knowing how to deal with it. Frankly, we were not at a level where we could deal with it except put up with it. But Lee is not the kind of person that you can deal with that way. And he promptly started doing something about it. And this resulted in a shootout, really, that included a number of us who were on the on Henry's list of Lee's associates.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Lee,
in fact, was a minor sublist.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so he went to Henry and told Henry that if that man didn't go, that this, not only he was leaving, but all of these other people were leaving as well, Ford Motor Company.
No.
Leaving as well, Ford Motor Company.
No, this is...
Lee saying to,
yeah,
to Henry.
Mm-hmm.
I think, without having, direct knowledge of that, of this judgment on my part, but I am came out of it convinced that act of that, and probably other acts that I'm not familiar with, were instrumental in forcing Henry to do the it was peculiar that he would bring Knudsen in, but it was only half as peculiar as it was canning Knudsen. That really looks strange. And I think that Lee was, in my mind, was the person that caused that to take place. And he laid it on the line that some of the best people in Ford Motor Company are, and myself, we're leaving. If you don't get this man out of here, probably understating it or simplifying it, but that's so. It was shortly after that confrontation that the chairman did oust. I saved the newspaper. I just saw it the other day. I've got to run it through the copy machine before it gets any more yellow. But it shows Henry on the front page and Lee sitting beside him, and it says, Knudsen is out, fired. And Lee looks pleased. There's no question about it that he was successful.
Well, yeah. Forgive me, that's fascinating. Not to put you too much on the spot, but do you really think that was that more than a bluff on Iacocca's part? Had he consulted with most of you about that possibility that if Knudsen stayed, it would be untenable for all of you?
Yes, he had discussed it, and
yeah.
I was ready. I was definitely had no. No problem with what he said at all. I would have left. I certainly was an ally of his in this particular circumstance, and so I wouldn't have had. I can't speak for the rest of the group, but I think that generally we would have. Yes, it would have. Yes, it really would have.
Yeah,
we might have come to Chrysler earlier.
Yeah,
right.
The disasters of the Knudsen reign, did they result in any other oddities? The large Mustangs, they became, I think under Shinoda's guidance, they became fatter and larger.
Yes,
and more
right.
Powerful.
Yes. Yes, right.
More garish.
Yeah, right. Right. They had the Knudsen, Shinoda, and Bill, and I'll pick up his name at some point in the conversation here. They were on a, and more so Knudsen and Shinoda really were the primary pursuers of the muscle cars of the future. To them, were big, you know, I mean, tanks really, and they really they did some. They were competition oriented people, and they really seemed, you know, just by their association with NASCAR and so forth, that's all they eat, sleep, and breathe. Engines and large displacement and bigger cars and fatter tires and so forth and so on. So they were, this was not a happy a happy course for the Mustang to be taken.
Right.
It was very unfortunate, and it grew bigger and bigger, and its demise was a direct part of that.
You're taking a really marvelous vehicle and just simply bloated it out of proportion.
Yes.
The turmoil is fascinating to me. The turmoil that this created, not only in design and styling, but in product planning and in product development, must have been enormous.
Yes, it was. It was. I think there's, as far as humans in general are concerned, and certainly a large element of them, do surprisingly well in an environment like that, though. I was discussing this recently with my wife. And it's a, I don't want to, you know, depart in too far into the psychological aspect of this, but it kind of intrigues me, because as I look at the subject, and I look at myself, and I look at others, I can sense that there are people that contribute and create turmoil, and there are many people who do quite well in a tumultuous atmosphere.
Yes. Thrive on dissension and
yes,
tension.
I have to say about myself, I think that I do fairly well in it.
You can hold your own.
Yeah, I don't like to think of me contributing to any of it at all, but from a career point of view, I think I unconsciously developed an affinity for tension and so forth. So
there are advocates of creative tension.
Yeah, I think, as I look back on it, I would have to be numbered among those people. That Knudsen was I knew something was going to happen to him. I never felt that anything was going to happen to Don Della Rosa, quite frankly. But as I say, I've been through so many presidents,
right,
that I wasn't terribly impressed with being only that I was honored that I was on the same hit list with Lee Iacocca. But I wasn't terribly impressed, or I didn't feel threatened. And I am fairly divisive and competitive, and so I didn't exactly sit on my hands, and so I I guess I do have to admit that I kind of thrive on it to a degree. It's a funny thing to know about yourself, because it's not supposed to be a very healthful thing, and we're supposed to avoid tension and so forth. But I guess the only thing, whether I'm being honest or not, is I hope I don't create it. But I guess I do. Enjoy it. I lethargy and so forth is maybe a little tougher for me than the tension and the abundance of activity, I guess, really.
Well, in the design business, I suspect this is a plus.
Well, I think it is. I think if you're really laid back, I think that your chances of really accomplishing a great deal and rising to into a level of responsibility, I think are very slim. I don't know, I shouldn't say that. I guess I always wanted to. I used to think about it from the point of view that I wished I'd my education program had been taken down a path that made me equip me to be a candidate to run the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I sensed that I really would like to run the company.
Uh-huh.
Which sounds strange coming from a designer, but I really would.
Certainly that era cried out for some kind of leadership.
Yeah, right. Yes, that's true.
The Shinoda influence began to wane, and when it became apparent that Newsom was in effect digging his own grave.
Right.
So within the design center, there began to some of you took heart again. Began to
yes, run. Right.
How did that final episode unravel?
Well, as soon as we really coincidental with the. And of course, I think Jean Bordenay was, being an officer in the company, was made aware of Knudsen's departure. And I think that morning he discharged Larry Shinoda, and called him in and discharged him. Gene made the decision to keep the one Knudsen person on, feeling he had conducted himself, which he had really, in a way that didn't Gene's judgment was that Bill was an asset, had performed well, had not conducted himself as a Knudsen ally without regard for Ford or the Ford people. So he kept Bill on. Bill was still with the design center, works for Jack Telnak or Don Kopka. And Gene discharged Larry that day.
Is there any truth to the story that Larry was in Europe?
Yes, that's right. Yes, he was.
Gene, the story goes, as I think I've read it, simply said, "You're through."
Yes, right. Right, yeah, Gene called him, that's right, I'd forgotten about that, right. Larry was in Europe, and he got the news over there.
There's another amusing story which has surfaced, which you might be able to corroborate. Someone put up a design, a display of a sun, and somehow contrived so that it would, it sank slowly.
Oh, yes, right, I remember that. Yeah.
You remember, is that true?
That's true, yes, right.
You don't remember who did that or how that came about?
No, I don't remember what studio, really. I know it, I remember it and seeing it and so forth. Yeah, that, Larry, I think from a psychological point of view, in trying to understand why there would be this excessive hostility between himself and other people, particularly Occidentals. In my judgment, I would relate it to the fact that it came from the fact that he was Japanese American. His parents were Japanese Americans as well, and they suffered the reaction, the unfortunate one, as far as the U.S. government is concerned, and they were put in a stockade. And I think that, that's a 25-cent analysis of what really happened. But I thought, it could have an impact on a youngster, and it could have from then on, you could want to try to make things right, and that hostility was a form of taking some kind of action against the persons or their that may have been a part of that, and all Occidentals would be he'd lump them all together, and he's a very talented designer. Just does beautifully. I have a Tal Design book that features his work and a story about him, and he's very, very good. He did some beautiful work at General Motors on the Corvette and the Corvair and other cars, and he's a really outstanding designer. He's just I was amazed here several years ago, after I joined Chrysler. I went down for a ride through the fellow who handles Chrysler, display and exhibits. He has another company. Can think of his name. Anyway, George invited me down to ride on the golf cart and go through the Detroit Automobile Show before it was open. And so we're riding around, and who do we encounter but Larry Shinoda. And he was very, very friendly and courteous and in fact, followed that with being brought up, would like to talk to me about business and so forth, and told me he's opening a new business and has a place out in Franklin, a 13-mile road, and he wrote me a letter, followed it up, and said he was glad to see me and look forward to doing some business and so forth, and I never, for obvious reasons, I never pursued it. But anyway, it was. So he's he'd had a, I thought did some nice work for White and
yes.
And
apparently he went with
Knudsen. Went with Knudsen and did. I like his work. I always have. I liked his work, and he did. I thought his truck work was beautiful.
Was there any? Were there any positive aspects to the Knudsen Shinoda regime in terms of design decisions the short time they were there? Do you remember?
No, I remember there weren't.
There weren't No. There were some near disasters. We talked about the Mustang. Were there any others that you can recall?
Well, the Thunderbird was a very...
They ruined the front end?
Ruined the front end of, of the Thunderbird. Made a very strange-looking three-element opening with a simulation, really, of the by Knudsen's direction of the Pontiac, and it happened to be my responsibility. So I'm, I guess you could lay off the design responsibility on me.
But you were under the gun.
Well, yeah. I mean, Knudsen, he was. At this point, you know, Lee is a classy person. He, if he's going to fight Knudsen, he does it in his own way, and he doesn't take the route a lot of men would, is come in, hear about Knudsen being over there, and come over there and fight with Knudsen in front of the employees. I mean, that's not a class way to do it, and he's a classy person, and so... All of the preparation for getting Knudsen sacked was done with finesse behind the scenes.
Really presented Henry Ford with a fait accompli. He really had to make that decision.
Right, he did. Yeah, it was. I thought it was a nice piece of work on Lee's part. I mean, God.
It's not been generally recognized from that angle. I think I'm glad to have your viewpoint on that.
Yeah, I guess there hasn't been a lot discussed about it.
So there you are, about 1970.
Yes.
Mr. Right. Knudsen has left. Mr. Shinoda's baleful influence has been removed from the design center. And there you are, you and Gene and Mr. Iacocca. I've got to try to make some sense out of the wreckage. And, what kind of decisions came out of that matrix? I know you. I think you felt by this time that the Mustang was pretty much a lost cause, and that you'd had to come up with a couple of other ideas at this time.
Yes. Well, we shortly, well, in that time frame, we began restoring the Mustang,
right.
And I worked on the as part of Advanced, I worked on the next generation of Mustang,
right.
And I had an associate designer working with me, a fellow by the name of Tony Yuki, who was an extremely talented fellow. And
how do you spell Tony's last name?
I think it's I think it's YKI. Yeah, I believe so. We did I have the book somewhere. I wished I could find it. I know it's in my basement. A book that I kept, a black three-ring binder, which I kept the history of the Mustang in. That is, from a standpoint of, because as being responsible for Advanced, it hadn't yet been turned over to the passenger car studio that, like Joe Orris's. In the Ford studio, so Tony and I worked personally very closely on this. We called the car the Allegro, and I think that we did somewhere around 25 cars, and we had a very, very nice design. Very, very advanced, very modern, very clean, and we were carrying out what responding to Lee's desire to settle on what the proportion should be, what the wheelbase should be, etc. And so we have these Allegros cranking out, and Bordenay, I remember, giving us the benefit of his judgment was that it was important. I don't know whether he got this from Lee or whether he fabricated it, but whatever it was, the thing was that for, you know, in order to keep apples and apples, every Allegro had to have the same design. If it's 96 inches wheelbase, or it's 90, or it's 103, or what, or the, you move the passenger compartment forward or aft, whatever, it's the same design. Well, that proved to be a disaster, you know, from the standpoint of the design itself. I think it was a...
Yeah.
I think Gene would agree with me if he were to be asked that it was a beautiful car, and it was, it really, as great as the Mustang was that Joe Orris did, that was an old design. It may have been new to the Mustang, and it may have been new to the people, but it was a contrivance of elements that came from the Chrysler series that they did over at Ghia, and the mouth and the headlights in little mouths, and I'm not saying the one they approved was, there was anything wrong with it, but let's just say that personally, as a designer, I think ours was better. It's that simple.
Yeah.
And of course, the we got sunk because, in my view, because we had worn out the Allegro. I mean, we had shown it for, I don't remember how long it was, but it was like a year, you know, we had been showing Allegros. And by the time things were at the starting post, I think I was hearing, as I recall, I don't want you to change the Allegro design still. And so that Allegro design just was not competitive with, it had worn Lee out and others out, you know. This suddenly, this really older design really was looked upon as fresher. They hadn't seen the design, you know, before. So it was a going away winner, you know, which was...
That was very awkward.
It didn't go down well with me. I mean, I obviously can tell the story too well. You can see that I'm not exactly enthralled with the way it turned out. But and of course that was followed by an interesting, if it's appropriate, an interesting little vignette on the future of the Mustang.
Yes.
Because once we have that Mustang, the original Mustang, of course, and then we got into ruining it by getting it too overweight. We finally got into the addressing of the Mustang for the next generation and called it Mustang 2. And I had done a car, a Mustang, which I do have. I do have a picture. It's at home now, but I do have a picture of myself taken out in the courtyard with my Mustang candidate, and it was given a name because it was named after a city in Southern California where the market research was carried on. But back to the heart of the story is that when we started the Mustang, I I took the Mustang issue up with Lee, and I suggested that the in rationalizing it, that when we do this new Mustang, that, you know, let's not forget that the original Mustang was a notchback. That was followed with a fastback. So let's not do a fastback first. Let's do the notchback first. And my recollection is that it sounded like it made sense to him. Well, I got to work on a notchback Mustang, of course, right away at GIA, and also a version of it also notchback in the United States in Dearborn, and much to my shock and chagrin. There's a young designer by the name of Fritz Mayhew, who is, I guess, just about walks on water. And he didn't care nor know or agree or understand what I was talking about. And so he embarks on doing a Mustang fastback, and it was very attractive, very dramatic belt line and very nice looking car. Well, I'll be damned if Lee didn't buy it. Just 180 degrees from what we talked about. So then all hell broke loose trying to make a notchback out of that car. I mean, there was no way, and that accounts for the strange look of the Mustang II notchback. It never looked right. The C pillar always looked like a trunk of a tree growing out of the quarter panel. You know, it's you just don't do it. I mean, it's not doable. The car was a mild, weak success, and it just hung around, and that really was, I had trouble adjusting to that. A funny little aside on that. I've never been a Fritz Mayhew booster, and particularly because of that issue.
Yeah.
And I come over to Chrysler to take over the responsibility. I start walking around up on the fifth floor in different conference rooms and so forth. What do I see in the on the walls but a plethora of Fritz Mayhew paintings? I don't know how in the hell this all took place, but somehow somebody here really, he's a hell of a painter. He and his wife are very, very good artists. But it was funny, you know, because I thought, God almighty, here's Fritz Mayhew again, you know. So, but anyway, Fritz was...
he's still there, I think.
Oh, yeah, right. He's full of himself.
Yeah.
As I said, he walks on water. And but he really screwed that up. And of course, my... in fact, his car, either the guys who ran the market research fiddled with the facts, or I'm never sure about those fellows anyway.
Yeah, right.
They're,
I want to talk to you about that.
They are really strange, and they can take all that data and just tell about anything, you know, they want to tell with it. And so my notchback got sunk out in California,
Did it ever resurface?
No, it was the end of the car.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of staying power. I think they would have delayed revisiting the Mustang subject as early as they did. I gotta excuse myself.
So the Niceback design was submerged, and this left you in what kind of a situation there then at the design center at Ford?
Well, I had other responsibilities, so we moved ahead on other projects. We were closing in. I'm trying to get my dates organized here, but we were beginning to approach the period, at least, where the GIA interest was emerging and so forth.
I'll ask you a bit about that. Mm-hmm. At this point, Ford had pretty much taken it over in terms of controlling interest.
Yes.
How did that come about? Do you recall?
Well, it's my understanding that Lee took the initiative and purchased GIA from DiTommaso. My original experience and relationship with GIA started many years earlier. I had been back in 1953, 54, 55. I had started going to Italy. In fact, I'd found some paper work here recently in a file that where I was identified on the paper as a contract negotiator, and I went over for a period to negotiate the contractual arrangement with various carrozzerias like Vignali and certainly GIA and Bertone and a number of others, and then that was followed with the awarding of some build contracts to Luigi Segre in Torino. And I started going. I worked on a number of cars in Italy, in the mid '50s and late '50s. So I had a substantial amount of experience with Italy and particularly GIA.
This is in line with your work in the advanced studio.
Yes, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Chrysler had a foot in the door pretty much during the 50s and 60s at GIA.
Right, they did, yes. They did. Luigi Segre and his chief designer and chief engineer, whose name I can't remember, who later, by the way, left GIA and joined Chrysler as head of advanced engineering here at Chrysler. Quite an outstanding engineer, very nice gentleman. I was delighted when I was chosen to after they purchased GIA, I was chosen to be the president and the chairman of the board of GIA. It was a wholly owned subsidiary of Ford, and my first experience with a profit center operation, which is unique to people in large companies whose careers generally reside in an area that is cost center oriented, and it's quite a different kind of life. And so it was very exciting for me. I really enjoyed it.
Could I ask you at this point to sort of describe how the GEA connection worked in terms with Ford and earlier? Were they, obviously they made the body design decisions for you, but how did the whole thing, the whole matrix work?
Well, Lee, I think it's safe to say, viewed GEA as being an opportunity to offer Ford Motor Company a well-known name, coach builder's name, that we could put the badge of GEA on a premium line of vehicles, and that was followed by Ford of Europe as well, the GEA model. I think it's safe to say in the hierarchy of Ford, there were some misgivings about GEA. When I took it over, DiTommaso had been, I think the previous year had done about six models. I think in my first year and the following years, I got up to into the 20 to 22, 23 models a year. I was quite aggressive about it. I viewed it as just a heck of an opportunity. Number one, it gave me an opportunity that was a little unique in that I was a Dearborn person who attended and was aware of the long-range plans, the strategies and so forth that were being were popular in Dearborn. I could take a reading on Bourdonnais' direction that he was taking. So I enjoyed a lot of autonomy, quite frankly, that permitted me to make decisions at GEA that were quite remote from Dearborn. In other words, I carried on a battle with Harold MacDonald for quite an extended period over the subject, and I had Bourdonnais' support. I pause a moment to say that some of the autonomy, I don't mean to be unappreciative, but some of the autonomy that Gene allowed me at GEA, I think as I look back, was the result of Gene's penchant for his awareness and his capacity to deal in the general field of top management. He was very, very concerned that something could go south with GEA, and he didn't want to have any of that rub off on him. So he, you know, I ended up being having the fortuitous benefit of Gene's looking after Gene. That was nice, you know. But I don't mean to be unkind, but I think that was one of the things he had on his mind, because there was a lot of talk about that. It was a very little suspect.
I wonder why.
I never understood it. In fact, one of the where I first became aware of it was a very surprising phone call I got from executive vice president or vice president of finance, Ed Lundy. Now, Ed Lundy had never called me in my life, you know, so this is enough. It gets your attention, you know. So I had just taken over as president of GIA, and Ed Lundy's office called and said that that Mr. Lundy would like to have you come over at a certain time and talk to him. Well, I couldn't figure out why, you know. So anyway, I went over, and Ed is a very, very nice fellow, very courteous, very, at least to the degree that I know him at all, which is fairly shallow, but he a very nice person, impressed me that way. And so we sat down, and he started talking about why he wanted to talk to me, had me come over. It was to talk about GIA. Now he didn't elaborate on his concerns. All he said was that he had some concerns, and one of the things that he wanted to ensure that I understood was that I think his choice of words was that that GIA be a success, and I think he said also that he didn't want anything to happen at GIA that would in any way put Lee Iacocca's career in jeopardy.